One of the things I really like about Father's Day is all the specials that they run, but I've been reading through the newspapers, and I think there are actually more Mother's Day specials than there are Father's Day specials. I don't know why that works, because, you know, I'd like the Father's Day because they have the tools and stuff, but there's a limited number of stores that sell tools, but virtually everybody sells something that mothers need. And so a Mother's Day special this morning is Luke chapter 8, where we have two women. One is a 12-year-old girl, and one is a woman who's had an issue, a medical issue, for 12 years. Both of these passages are intended by Luke to be dealt with in one sitting, which is difficult because we certainly want to go to Country Burger. But the 12s tie them together. And another key to understanding, well, just to see the similarities, is that the term immediately repeats itself throughout. So you have the 12s, the two women, and the immediately. That's what puts these things together. So Luke chapter 8, we're in verses 40 through 50. And when you look at verse 40, I want to just start by saying these masses of people appear to cause the problems. It's just all of these people. Look at verse 40. So it was when Jesus returned, this is after the Gadarene demoniac, the multitude welcomed him. There's this massive numbers of people. In fact, it says down in verse 42 that they were choking him, literally. They were so tight you couldn't go anywhere, couldn't do anything. These massive numbers of people, for they were all waiting expectantly for him. That is, they had been waiting and waiting for him to come. And nobody was leaving. So this massive numbers of people. And you would think that in all of the massive numbers of people in 840 that appear to cause the problem, that Christ would not have time or interest in the individual. Lots of people are not a problem for Jesus. One of the abilities he has is being God. He's omnipresent. He's omniscient. It's just not a problem for him to have massive numbers of people and to seek out each of the individual people. Sometimes, you know, we say, well, God loves the world, and people think, yeah, he does. He loves the world, but that doesn't mean he loves me. And in this passage, you'll see the massive numbers of people, and I think what Luke is doing is actually showing that there's a contrast between all of these people and the interference with what Christ would do with the individuals. But he shows, by putting these two stories together, that even though there are massive numbers of people, Christ is still very, very, very interested in the individual. So notice this as we go through the passage. In verses 41 and 42, we're introduced to Jairus' daughter. And behold, a man named Jairus came, and he was the one ruling the synagogue. So his job is synagogue ruler. He'd be a person that everybody knew his name. Probably after this adventure, he became a believer. So here's at least one synagogue where you have the ruler of it who's going to be truly a fan of Jesus. And he was falling at the feet of Jesus and was begging him. It's not just once or twice, but multiple times. He came, this ruler who'd be with some pomp and circumstances, you know, as Jewish religious systems tend to go. You don't have a problem telling who's the leaders and so forth. He doesn't have any regard for his own reputation. He came and he fell at Christ's feet and was begging him to come to his house. And the reason is given in verse 42. Because a daughter, an only daughter, the only one born to him, probably that he didn't have any sons, he only had this daughter. And she was about 12 years old. Is that me? Oh, good. She was about 12 years old. She was 12 years old. And she was dying. in the active state of dying. Again, not a question of whether this is going to end well. So Jairus comes and he throws himself at Christ's feet, begs him to come to his house because his daughter is actively dying. But in the going, as he was going, the crowd was choking him. Again, the crowd interfered. So he's going to go to Jairus' house, but he can't get there because of all the people. They're choking him around, packed in like you were going to ship at UPS. Just no space, no room. Can't move, can't manipulate, can't maneuver. All right, now in verses 43 and 44, we're going to meet a woman whose only hope is Christ. Look at verse 43. And a woman having a flow of blood for 12 years. So you have a little girl who's dying at the age of 12, and here you have a woman who for 12 years has been having a serious medical problem. Who having spent all on the manner of life, bion, which is biography, what she spent everything that she had, all of her manner of life was spent on doctors, only she was not able to be healed by any of them. And no matter which doctor she went to, she couldn't catch health. Real interesting how the Greek puts the term together, that you know, you would go and you'd like lighting a candle, you get the flame next to the wick and it leaps. Every doctor she went to couldn't give her any help, and she spent everything she had in those 12 years. So this woman, this desperate woman whose health is frail and failing, she approached him, verse 44, from behind. And she touched the outer edge, the fringe of his outer cloak. So she comes up behind him and she touched, and the term's in the middle voice, which means for her own benefit. She knew what she was doing. She came up and from behind him just touched the fringe of his outer coat. Now, a normal person would never have known that he'd even been touched. Remember, he's in a crowd being choked by people. Just touched the fringe of his garment. And immediately, right there at that very moment, on the spot, the flow of her blood stopped. Immediately she was healed. You know, so as we're going through this whole section, you know, pay attention to Christ. You know, just the incredible power of Christ. This is not some kind of a circumstantial magic trick. This is Christ healing the woman without her realizing that it's Christ who knows her. Okay, all she's thinking is, if I can just get there and touch him, and she does. So her only hope is Christ, and she comes up and immediately she's healed. Now in the next verses, 45 to 48, you'll see that our development of faith is vital to the Lord. Christ already knew all about this woman, right? He's God. He has this knowledge. He already knows about her. He actually knows every single individual in the entire crowd that's pressing around him. Part of the issue with omniscience is that there's nothing that you can learn. Now, I don't want to go into the difficult passages where he learned obedience. It's different context he experienced. The whole concept of omniscience is that he knows all real and actual and hypothetical possibilities. So he already knows every single person in the crowd. And the voluntary submission of his divine attributes to the will of the Heavenly Father doesn't change that Christ is fully God in every sense of the word. And as God, he has those attributes. And knowing the woman came, knowing the woman touched him, his interest is not in trying to figure out who touched him. He already knows that. His interest is in the development of faith. Christ's concern for you is your development of faith. Let's look at the next verse. And Jesus said, Who is the one having touched me? And he uses the middle voice as well. Who is the person who touched me for their benefit? Real interesting. And it's emphatic. Who touched me? That's what we'd say in English. Who touched me? Now, when everybody was denying it, so Christ stops all these people around and makes the statement, who touched me? For their benefit, who touched me? So that excludes people rubbing shoulders with him, right? Somebody in that crowd touched him for their own benefit, just the fringe of his garment. And he knew it. Of course, he knows everything. So he says, who touched me? And even the people who bump shoulders, he's not talking to me because I bump shoulders. I bump shoulders because I got squished in by the crowd. But that's not, I didn't touch them for my benefit. So he says, who for their own benefit touched me? Now when all were denying it, they one after the other, Peter, this is great, Peter and the ones with Peter said to him, Master, just in case you hadn't noticed, the multitudes are pressing you and crowded all around. So, okay, surely you're mistaken, Master, because they look at all these people around you, and surely there's a mistake here. And he said, who touched me? So Peter and the other disciples, I mean, it's the whole crowd is stopped. He was on his way to see the little 12-year-old who's dying. The whole crowd is stopped, and Christ said, who touched me? And everybody denies it. And then the disciples, since Christ is so emphatic, said, hey, you know, there's a crowd here. Maybe it's just take a deep breath. And so after Peter's nice explanation, Christ said, who touched me? Again, speaking over his disciples, not even addressing the lack of faith on the part of the disciples. You know, you never want to get yourself in a position where you're trying to explain to the Lord what he already knows. You know, that's a really bad spot. He speaks over them and he says, who touched me? And Jesus said, notice verse 46. Now, your text translates this a little differently. But it's really essentially the same words, same exact words. And it's just, I believe, a repetition. The difference is the order of it. And I don't think it should be translated indefinitely, someone touched me. I think at this third time in verse 46, he rearranges it because he's not going to let this go. Touched me who? He's been saying, who touched me? He said it twice. First time, the disciples gave him the explanation. He says it again. Here, he says it a third time. And it's like he underscores, who are you? Who are you? Okay? Are you with me? For I know, he says, for I know power has gone out from me. Okay? So now he says, who are you? I know I have healed you. Very interesting in my thinking, man. So this woman who's gone to boatloads of doctors, who's so timid that she can't even begin to speak to Christ, fights her way through this choking crowd, reaches out and touches his garment, and shrinks back and knows immediately that she's been healed. Christ stops and says, who touched me? Who touched me? And the disciples say, yeah, there's no, we've got a lot of people here. You're probably mistaken. No, who are you? Because I know that I healed you. What's important here is the development of her own faith. Verse 47. Didn't go the way she planned. Things rarely do with the Lord. The woman, now having seen that she was not hidden. Oh, rats. She knows she's healed. She knows Christ healed her. She's already shrunk back into the crowd. Oh, rats. Christ isn't moving. He's not going anywhere. Okay, the whole group has stopped. The disciples aren't going to talk him out of this. Knowing that she was not hidden, trembling, she came and fell before him and began to explain to him what reason she touched him. Again, using that middle voice, here's why I touched you. And declared to him before everybody, in the face of all the people. So she comes out from the crowd. All of a sudden, here comes the woman. At this point, she's poor because she's spent all her money. She collapses at the feet of Christ, I'm sure overwhelmed with emotion, and begins to declare to him, literally in the faces of all the people, how she was healed immediately. Immediately I was healed when I just touched your garment. And notice Christ's concern here, verse 48. And he said to her, "Be courageous, my daughter. Be courageous, daughter." All right, welcome to your new world, the world that has me as your God. So this timid woman, who is desperate, has no hope, now has met the Lord Jesus. And his first instructions are to make sure that she understands he knows her and he knows all about her. And she needs to be courageous. Stop being afraid. Stop withdrawing from everything. And step forward. It's a command. It's an imperative. Be courageous, daughter. That relationship that she now has with him. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Christ didn't want to make a spectacle of her. He simply wanted her to hear the words to her, "Daughter, you're mine." What about Jairus' daughter? "Daughter, you're mine. Stop being afraid. Now go, and go in peace." Remember, the problems these things cause to us, these crowds and these delays, are not a problem to Christ. One of the reasons these things aren't a problem is that resurrections are Christ's speciality. Look at verse 49. I hope I didn't do the training on this fellow who came from the synagogue. But while he was speaking, someone from the ruler of the synagogue saying to him, "Your daughter's dead." Actually, it starts with "has died." It's a perfect tense. She's died. She's dead and gone. She's buried. I mean, this daughter of yours is dead and gone. Stop troubling the teacher. So there's an imperative. So whoever it is comes with this news. She's dead. She's going to stay dead. So stop bothering the master. Don't bother to have him come to our house, to this house, because she's dead. Maybe it was Canadian, that blunt Canadian. Stands out in the crowd. He's got his one line. The whole crowd hears him. You know, he probably shouted at the top of "Your daughter has died, so stop troubling the teacher." Interesting, Jesus doesn't deal with the messenger at all. But he hears it. Everybody heard it. Answered to him saying, "Stop fearing, only believe, and she will be saved." The way this works out in the logistics of the house is kind of interesting. It looks a little different in different place. Verse 51, "And having come into the house, he did not permit anyone to go in." Well, his disciples went in and the parents went in. But the best I can figure out is that he didn't let anybody go in except for the disciples and the parents, but having done that, everybody went in. Okay, so, you know, he didn't let them come in, but then as soon as they were in the bedroom, guess what happened in the front door, in the kitchen, in the bed, you know, the den, everything else was filled up with people. So he wouldn't let them start coming in, but that's kind of how things go. You think you have it under management plans. He wouldn't let them go in except Peter and James and John and the father of the child and the mother. Now, everybody, they were wailing, they were howling, they were beating their chest. Have any of you all seen an Oriental funeral, that those professional wailers that they hire? It's scary. You've seen it on television, especially in the Middle East, where they get that wailing. That's what we're talking about here. Everybody is wailing and beating their bodies for her, that is, for this dead girl. So, and I'm assuming this takes place outside of the house. But he said, stop wailing. She's not dead. She's sleeping. So outside the house, before he took the three disciples and the mother and the father in, everybody's out there wailing and beating their chests. And he steps up on the stoop and he says, stop it. Just stop it. Stop wailing. She's not dead. She's sleeping. Now notice their immediate response of faith. That's a joke. Verse 53, and they were deriding him. They were ridiculing him. One in the crowd said, no, she's dead. Next in the crowd, no, I was there. I saw her. She's dead. And the other, you don't know what you're talking about. Again, it's a bad thing to get in that position with the Lord. If he says she's sleeping, I'd go with him every time. But they had seen the dead body. Okay, it's been enough time. There's no question the girl is dead. And so they instead of letting things work itself out, saying, well, we'll see, they're deriding him, they're ridiculing him. They're literally calling him names. Oh, you're an idiot. That's why you think she's sleeping. Knowing that she had died. They knew it. She was dead. Everybody knew she was dead. And so when he says that she's sleeping, they laugh him to scorn. They ridicule him. But he threw them all outside, and having taken her hand. So I'm not sure on the dynamics of this, because each of the Gospels, I think it's a mass scene of chaos with screaming, wailing people going in and out of the house. And Christ puts them all out. I'm not sure how the dynamics, the exact play-by-play worked out. But he casts them all out of the house. I thought he didn't let them in. Well, he didn't. But somehow they got in there. So he throws them out of the house. Everybody. These people that are mocking him. And having taken her hand, he called out saying, little girl, arise. He takes her hand. Little girl, arise. And her spirit returned, and she immediately arose. There's that theme of immediately. 12 years, and immediately she's healed. Her spirit returned. And as soon as her spirit returned, you think she spent any time lying on that dead bed? No. Immediately she got up. And he commanded her to be given something to eat. She needed to be eat. She commanded, get this poor girl something to eat. I mean, death is a traumatic experience. Get her something to eat. And her parents were literally out of their minds. They were astonished. They were completely out of their minds. Just couldn't believe their dead girl now is living. But Christ charged them that they shouldn't tell anyone what had happened. That no one be told what had actually taken place here. Why? Well, resurrections are his specialty, but he does them in his own time, in his own manner. Can you imagine what would happen to the ministry if word got out that Jesus can raise the dead? But this ruler of the synagogue and the delay of the crowd given to the woman with the 12 years of blood, all of those things combined to make this the right time for this little girl to be brought back together to life. My point from this passage is that Jesus has the time and the power for little girls and women. Happy Mother's Day. Jesse, come and lead us in a hymn, would you?